and welcome to today's Behind the Story podcast, brought to you by Higginson Strategy. I'm John Higginson. Today's episode is a panel discussion hosted by Higginson Strategy's Expert Bureau. Expert Bureau was set up in June 2020 to connect experts with the public and media during lockdown. It was founded on the back of research carried out by Higginson Strategy and consultants Populist, which found Britons were increasingly looking to experts for guidance in all areas of life during the pandemic. The Bureau has since hosted a series of webinars attended by hundreds of guests, as well as magnifying the voices of the experts in its stable to millions of people around the world. I hope you enjoy today's conversation. So, for our subject of today, what is the future of transport? We'll be talking about some of the big questions that have come up for all the way from rail to electric vehicles, taxis and other forms of transport. Joining us today, Kerry McCarthy, the Shadow Transport Minister. Michael Hurwitz is Director of Transport Innovation at Transport for London. Dominic Moxon-Trich is Director of Regulation and Public Policy at Bolt. Natalia Peralta-Silverstone is Head of Propositions at Octopus Electric Vehicles. And John Elledge is the columnist for the New Statesman. Welcome to all of you. So if I can direct that question first to Kerry, what is the future of transport?
Okay, well, obviously, I could talk at great length on this, but I thought that probably the easiest way to approach it would be to sort of say what I'm actually looking at in terms of my green transport brief. So I cover green transport and the future of transport, but there's obviously a lot of overlap. So the key priorities for me is how do we embed the move towards active travel during lockdown? We sort of see that car use is almost back to normal. It's in the 90-something percent. Public transport is still well below 50% of what it was, depending on the mode. And cycling is still up. But I think unless we embed that with better infrastructure and then the more ambitious plans like the Mini Hollands or the livable neighbourhoods or low traffic neighbourhoods, whatever you want to call them, we may soon lose that advantage, particularly just as the weather gets worse and as people do return to public transport. There's a whole, I think, social justice issue about access to bikes and safety of bikes, people having on-street storage where they can actually keep their bikes safe. Where do e-scooters and e-mopeds and all this sort of thing fit into the mix? Because it's one thing putting in a 2-foot wide cycle lane, but once you start having the e-scooter pilots and all that, that issue out the road space is, there's an awful lot of questions. One thing also is some local authorities are really good on this. There's others that I think need a lot more pressure put on them to actually adopt this agenda. On the car use in particular, Labour's policy is to bring forward the ban on the sale of new ICE vehicles to 2030. Government is technically 2040, but consulting on bringing it to maybe 2035, and the Committee on Climate Change said 2032. So I'm kind of looking at, the government is very much just looking at charging infrastructures and then the market will lead the way. If you look at what France and Germany are doing, which is tied in with the whole green recovery package, so support for car manufacturing, they're looking at things like scrappage schemes, zero emission vehicle mandates, more on grants and that. So there's a lot that I'm doing with Lucy Powell in Bays on that. And one of the things, obviously, there's a whole issue about people not going into the office as much. But another thing that's happened during lockdown is the rise in online deliveries. And we're looking at whether we should be looking at distribution hubs around cities with then things being decanted into e-vans or e-cargo bikes, and just how you plan for that. Obviously, from shipping to trains to buses, there's a whole issue about moving to cleaner vehicles as well, and sustainable aviation fuels, lighter aircraft. Although I was quite sceptical of all those things before I got this brief and actually had sort of meetings. I thought that people talking about the technological approach to reducing aircraft emissions rather than just reducing demand was a bit of a greenwash on it and a bit of a distraction. But actually, there's some really interesting stuff going on in terms of electric short haul flights and hydrogen carbon capture and storage for the longer flights. Even just tidying up airspace could reduce emissions by 15% because planes could fly in direct lines and not have to sort of circle for ages. So, and as I said, maritime, all that side of things, you know, looking at decarbonisation across the board. So that's quick canter through what I'm up to.
Great. So some really interesting points there, you know, talking about how we deal with electric scooters as they come along. Lots of talk on electric. I remember just 2 weeks, it's 2 or 3 weeks ago that the Sunday Times ran on the front page how lots of flights had saved about 20% on fuel because they were just going in a straight line now instead of traditional routes that came in the 1950s or something that they've been following. So that's really interesting. And I'd love to come back to you on how you're working with Bayes and working with the government. Natalia, let's bring you in now, talking about electric vehicles. What's the view from Octopus?
Yeah, I mean, Kerry's actually already touched upon a few of the elements of what's going on and what we need to be focusing on now as part of the recovery, like other countries are doing. I can speak as to what we've been seeing at this point in the process. Sales are still really strong. So we actually lease electric cars, Octopus electric vehicles, and we're part of an energy company. So we tie it all in. And we've actually seen more demand than pre-COVID. Now that could be latent demand of people who couldn't get cars during COVID. But there's a couple of elements that show that might not be the case. So, you know, this time last year, we've seen a 250% increase in sales from the same period. And we're also seeing people look at EVs in a greener way. So not just it's a car that gets me from A to B, but we've seen huge benefits around air quality whilst we've been in lockdown. You know, you take vehicles off the road, we're going to have better air quality in our cities. And if we're going to put cars back on the road, which we're not necessarily advocating that everyone should drive a car, you know, do take public transport if you can, it should at least have zero tailpipe emissions. So we're also seeing a shift there in terms of mindset and why people are buying. There are a couple of elements we need to be mindful of coming out of lockdown. It's not just about lockdown. You know, we have Brexit coming in January, and that can affect the motor trade industry considerably. And we need to continue offering support to this industry. So, you know, the motor trade has been really affected in terms of sales, and they've also been, I guess, fundamentally affected in the sense that they have to be in physical dealerships to sell cars. So companies like ours are actually doing quite well because we're digital. But there still needs to be some support there to help, I guess, this trade survive kind of post-lockdown reality. And there's a real opportunity now to get behind pure electric vehicles or clean transport. You know, it doesn't just have to be electric, but it should be purely clean transport. So I think it's now time to kind of move away from kind of your plug-in hybrids. And if we're going to be supporting part of this industry, it should be electric.
Great, thank you. So some really good points there. Dominic, let's bring you in now on the view from the taxi trade.
Okay, well, Bolt is a competitor to Uber. We operate in about 40 countries throughout Europe, Middle East and Africa. We've got about 1 million drivers globally, 300,000 in Europe and 40,000 in London. So we are the second biggest PHV operator in the UK. We also operate e-bikes and electric scooters as well. Look, to Kerry's point, our volumes, both globally, but also in London, are back to pre-COVID levels. You know, our total number of trips last week in London was a record. You know, the sort of beating our sort of number in early February, which was our highest number. So I think the first thing that we're seeing is there has been a significant substitution by passengers who've moved away from mass transit and into cars, whether privately owned or via ride hailing networks. And that is clearly unsustainable, not least because of another point that Kerry made about the removal of road space. So there has been a shift in infrastructure away from accommodating private vehicles, be they cars, be they vans, and towards active transport modes. And this has been systemic all over Europe. We saw the same thing happen in France, in Paris. We saw the same thing happen in Berlin. And I think this shift towards active transport modes is something that we would like to see public authorities continue to push on to make sure that we sustain that modal shift. And for private operators such as us, I think that there is a responsibility for us, for example, in using, you know, nudge type techniques to push people who might otherwise, you know, summon a private hire vehicle for a short run journey, encouraging people to use e-bikes or e-scooters, howsoever they are to be accommodated on the roads, toward out of ICE vehicles and onto green at point of use transport modes. So I think that's the first thing. I think looking into the medium term, I think there will inevitably be a gradual reversion to the norm, because I think, you know, we are in a completely unsustainable position at the moment with people avoiding mass transit, public transit in favour of private vehicle use. I think in terms of the sort of long range trends and the kind of things that's on Michael Hurwitz's agenda, I think we're going to see ever more integration of, you know, private sector transport providers such as us into publicly owned transport networks. TfL was a world leader here in making its API, which is a way of joining databases together, in opening TfL's APIs so companies such as us could integrate into them. I think we will see more of that kind of thing going forward. I think the days of the likes of, you know, Bolt simply paying a license fee to exploit a scarce public asset such as road space are over. I think the future looks much more like, you know, real-time data sharing with public authorities, so that public authorities such as TfL are able to glean the benefit of, you know, the scale of our data sets, not to mention their own.
Great. So some positive comments from Dominic towards Michael there. I don't know if that's going to help with any licenses or anything else, but very interesting to hear from Dominic that actually, while lots of people in London in particular are still working from home, he's saying that the number of car journeys were last week at the maximum level that they'd ever hit. Now, we know that people have been getting mixed messages on a whole load of things from the government, but one of the mixed messages they've got is go into the office but don't use public transport. I remember I read a week or two ago that one company was telling people that if they use public transport, they'd have to go on quarantine for 2 weeks, which I think is appalling. I'll say I have been using public transport to get into the office since July, and it's been absolutely great. It's felt like one of the safest places in London when you go to the pubs, the parks, restaurants and stuff, and there's hardly anyone on it. Michael, why don't you tell us about your situation then? Because I don't think it doesn't sound like so far it's been quite as rosy as Dominic's is.
Well, it's been extremely challenging, and I can talk about kind of where we've been so far and what we're going to see in short term and then maybe in the longer term. I think the first thing I've got to say is that the traditional economics of transport currently do not apply. You know, there was this basic principle that, you know, if transport was big enough and busy enough, then it kind of washes its face. London historically has been, what I think, was it something like 72% covered by fare box revenue. And clearly that just fell away in the deepest, darkest moments of lockdown. Tube patronage was down 95%, buses were down 85%. For various reasons, because we only wanted to encourage essential trips around there. You know, there was no congestion charge, etc. So I think the first thing to say is that, you know, the economics is just not sustainable. And I think whilst I do agree with Dominic that there will be some reversion to the norm, it's going to feel a little bit less certain than it was. You know, I think that there's some really big, interesting and difficult questions about how much people will return to where they were before. You know, people are getting the value of having more flexibility. A lot of businesses are thinking about, do they need the same kind of footprint of office space in commercial centres, etc. So I think the first thing is that a lot of the traditional assumptions are now being challenged and shaken. And, that creates long-term uncertainty. Where we are now is that we're trying to do everything we can to make public transport safe and to make people feel as confident as they can in it. You know, we're using hospital-grade antiviral cleaners on everything, putting dispensers of hand gel on every station. The compliance with wearing masks is actually pretty high. Not uniformly throughout the day, but it's pretty high, and huge information campaigns to try and make people feel more comfortable about this. Transport is going to be part of getting city life, and talking from London's point of view, you know, urban life back to a form of normal that we can all recover economically, socially, and from an inclusion point of view. So, you know, we're trying to do a lot of things. I think what I would say is, and building up on some of the points, is that good set of questions about how much will COVID change things for the long term. I just wanted to mention two. Is that I think the first one is about the spatial distribution between, you know, city and commercial centres versus the suburbs. You know, I think there's a really interesting question is whether we will return to the same amount of commercial space and kind of density that we had before. Our economics does depend on that, but are we going to see a resurgent localism? I think that's a really interesting question. You know, local areas might become more vibrant, but that might put pressure on commercial centres. I think the second thing is that, and I have a strong sense here, that some of these behavioural shifts that we've seen through lockdown might be accelerated into the business as usual. So, for example, I would argue the shift to electric vehicles, I think that's accelerated people's adoption of that as an option, as a potential thing they could move to. Similarly, we've mentioned freight and urban delivery. You know, I think people have seen how much they can transact not by going out. And I think that's the kind of stuff that some of the really interesting questions are. You know, where do people place themselves in their businesses? What are the modes they choose? And how do they get their products and services? I think that's the really interesting set of variables for the future now.
Great, very interesting. And actually, some of those things that you're talking about there is really brings us into the future of living, the future of working as well. And John, that's something you've written a lot about. You've written a lot about what cities of the future look like. Is there anything you want to add to what Michael said there? What does the future of transport look like in you know, 5-10 years time?
I mean, the honest answer is we don't know, do we? Because we're still very much in the middle of this situation. We have no idea whether the talk of people working from home en masse for the long term is overblown or not. So much of what the transport system is currently constituted is for is around commuting. It's effective. So transport policy is sort of slightly dictated by the relative positions of homes and workplaces. Commuting is literally one of you know, a handful of inventions that enabled cities to get bigger than a million people. If you look back at the sort of the history of the largest city in the world, it kind of hovers around 1 million for 2,000 years nearly, and then when we invent the train, suddenly it becomes possible to have cities of 6, 10, 20, 30 million. So it's hugely important, and also a shift to the service economy has seen more and more of our economy dragged into fewer and fewer places. So you ended up with a situation where, you know, cities like London or Oxford or Bristol to a certain extent end up with crazy house prices because that's where the jobs are. And there's other places where housing is much more affordable, but there aren't any jobs. If the talk of more people working from home isn't just talk, if that becomes a thing where people don't go into the office 5 days in a week anymore, they might probably be, you know, within a couple of hours of the office, so they can go in 2 days or something. But suddenly a lot of people are working from home. All of these assumptions around which we've built, not just our transport system, but our entire economy for the past 30, 40 years, could topple in a way that's going to be quite unpredictable in the way it plays out. So much of government transport investment, not just this government, but governments going back decades, has been in and around London, because somewhere in Whitehall there is a spreadsheet that shows it is very easy to make a commercial case for something like Crossrail, because if you build another big railway line under London, it will be possible to boost the economy by 0.5% or something. You can see the sort of cost-benefit stacks up quite easily, whereas building, I don't know, a speculative tram network in Bradford, it's harder to make that case. If suddenly, like, we don't need however many people a day commuting into central London, is the mass there going to stack up anymore? Is it possible we're going to find out we've been investing in totally the wrong things? And the boring answer is right now, we don't know. I don't think we have the faintest idea what the world of work and therefore the world of commuting and therefore the future of transport is going to look like in 5 years' time, because we don't know if this is kind of a short-term shift or something that's going to have a much longer tail. There was an interesting thread I spotted on Twitter the other day by, I can't remember who it was, but someone pointing out that the reason people are not going back to the office is not just because they're scared. It's also because it's not easy to make the case that they will get anything out of it. The economy as a whole might, but individual people will not. So unless there is something on offer to sort of push people back to the old ways of doing things, it's possible that things are going to change. The other point I just wanted to make is briefly at this point was a sort of more short-term one. I think there is an inherent tension in the way the sort of COVID-era transport policy has been managed. Obviously, the fear of crowded public transport is pushing people towards these more private options. We are seeing sort of gratifying shift towards cycling policy. We're seeing, you know, attempts to set aside more space for it, attempts to sort of persuade people to get their bikes fixed up, or, you know, money to invest in bike parking at stations. Not all of these plans have come to fruition. There's been a lot more talk of plans than there had actually been ones that have happened, but we are seeing real things. There's an exciting new network in Coventry, I believe. There are bits of London we're starting to see this sort of stuff. There's also in Greater Manchester, for reasons that are not entirely clear to me, the cycling network is in the outer boroughs and stops dead when you get to the boundaries of the actual city of Manchester. So it's not going brilliantly, but this stuff is happening. But against that, cycling is still very much a minority sport. You know, it's not something we're ever going to, not something, I don't think we never could. I don't think we are anytime soon going to see a mass move to it. And a lot of the people who are avoiding public transport are in fact going to be moving towards private cars. So it's that's where the tension lies. There is this difficulty because to get more people cycling, you need to take space away from cars. But obviously we are now seeing more people moving back to cars. And in any clash between cars and bicycles, whether in public policy or on the road, cars do tend to win. So I'm not quite sure how that's going to play out. But I do think we kind of need more effort on policy making in that area, because the reasons to get people out of the cars aren't purely about emissions and the environment and so on. It's also basic geometry. It's like, you know, someone driving a private vehicle is taking up a lot more space than someone on a bike or on a bus or on a train will. And so those other methods of transport mean you can move more people in smaller spaces. So in the long term, we definitely need to be working out how to get people out of their cars. I'm just not quite convinced that's something we're sort of pushing for right now.
Great. Thank you, John, and thank you all of you for your opening statements. That brings me quite nicely into, we're getting lots of questions from the audience on electric scooters and talking about how we get people out of cars rolls on nicely to a question that's come to us from Thomas McPhail. Dominic's already answered in part in writing, but I think it's one that would be going to Kerry, in that should we move away from if we legalise electric scooters to when we do, using insights from the trials to shape that legislation. I'd love to hear as well what you're doing with Bayes on that. And Thomas McPhail is from Pure Electric.
When scooters were first mooted, I think there were only going to be four areas. So there's four future areas that were going to pilot them. It was going to be a genuine pilot. And then the government, at the start of lockdown, then I think slightly, I didn't know whether it was sort of panic mode or whether they thought it was a good opportunity to sort of experiment in more places. But it's happening in far more places. And I've questioned them, you know, both in writing and through written parliamentary questions as to what the criteria is, what are they trying to find out? What will be deemed to be a success at the end of the pilot? And I don't think they've got any sort of established criteria. I think it is basically, as Tom said, it's, this is happening. This is, this will be a way of perhaps ironing out some of the problems. And we've already seen, I mean, there's been real delay in getting them on stream, but the ones that were up in Tees Valley, there's been issues about people, you know, although there's meant to be an age limit and you're meant to have a provisional license, the company running them just requires you to tick a box to say it's fine. There's been reports of kids sort of racing through shopping centres on them, which is entirely predictable. It was just obvious that this is going to be a fun thing for kids to do. And there's also the whole issue that people don't, you know, what do you do about people who've bought their own electric scooters and they're going to stop, you know, there are already lots of people using them on the roads when it's illegal to do so. But yeah, I think it is basically, this is happening, it's going to be rolled out. Any sort of problems with the schemes will be deemed to be either sort of solvable by tweaking the details of the hire schemes, or it would be a matter for local authorities. So I think it's there. The question is, though, you know, in terms of volume, it's one thing having, I think, yeah, Bristol's due to start its pilot soon, and it'll be Bristol and Bath. And I think there'll be about 500 scooters, which isn't that many. There's a big difference between 500 rental scooters on the streets of two cities to everybody sort of deciding that e-scooters are the way forward and bringing their own ones out onto the streets. And so in terms of what the pilots will evaluate, they're looking at a very, very small scale project compared to what the potential would be.
Very good. Dominic, do you want to just add to that in case anyone hasn't seen your reply?
No, absolutely. Happy to. I mean, as Kerry says, I mean, they are an awful lot of fun to ride. And, you know, particularly in, say, Bristol, for example, which is hilly, you know, there are, you know, predictable, you know, people heading down some of the steeper hills on e-scooters is entirely predictable. There's a question in the chat from Holly Jones about people who are under 16 and whether or not those people have public liability insurance. And I think what she's pointing at is a similar issue that Tom McPhail from Pure is pointing out in the Q&A, which is that DfT's guidance to local authorities on best practice in e-scooter trials, frankly, was pretty rough and ready. You know, Tom rightly points out that there's no provision made for private ownership, so, you know, use by private individuals. So in effect, what's being granted is a, you know, a monopoly to operators in local areas. But more importantly, there isn't, for example, a hard and fast requirement that operators A, should be, you know, forced to, you know, definitively verify that, you know, customers, passengers or riders are actually over the age of 16. We can do it. I think we're the only operator that can do it. We'd like to see it made a regulatory requirement to drag everybody else up to the same standards of regulation that the PHV industry already requires us to operate at. Similarly, I mean, it's very hard, I think, to justify as an e-scooter operator not having third-party liability insurance in any area of operation. We've committed to it in, you know, every area which, you know, we might operate in, and, you know, going forward we would continue to do so. But I think, you know, some of, you know, the smaller, how shall I put it, sort of, you know, more ambitious sort of market entrants, you know, aren't willing to make this same commitment to public safety. So I think, you know, there are potentially some very great benefits to be had from e-scooters. I think they do have to be carefully controlled. For example, you know, most Paris, for example, there's defined pickup and drop-off areas, which gets us past the public nuisance problem, which has been pointed to also in the Q&A. I mean, this is going to be fiendishly difficult in London, where TfL only controls the strategic road network, and a sort of mosaic of 38 local authorities all have jurisdiction over, you know, non-strategic road network. So, you know, potentially every council will have its own policy on pickup and drop-off areas. And, you know, we'd like to see when eventually it is, you know, possible for operators such as us to bid for opportunities to operate e-scooters in London. We'd like, you know, to see absolutely the highest standards and the best practice from regulation from elsewhere in Europe replicated in the capital, because otherwise it's going to be a bun fight. I mean, if you look at, you know, Oslo, I mean, they're knee deep in the damn things at the moment because, you know, bluntly, left to their own devices, operators will flood the market to attain a dominant market position. And that's, you know, unsustainable. And, you know, Michael and his colleagues are going to have to think about that from the get-go.
Yeah, can I come in there? I think it's, I take the point now that we are in a kind of rough and ready environment. I think for the long term, absolutely fundamental to the micromobility market is city permitting powers. I think that's absolutely, you know, a kind of a pass-fail criteria, frankly, for central government for controlling the rental market, because we've seen it time and time again where there is no permitting requirement, no ability to control, I guess, numbers, safety standards in particular is, I think, our biggest concern in TfL. You know, it's open season, you get flooded, and you need to be able, through either a permitting regime or some contractual regime, if not regulation, to say, look, these are the standards, these are the operating behaviours that you have to comply to, and that's how you get order. I do think, though, that as was already raised, you know, people won't just rent them. And I think there's quite an important point and a role for government to consider about standards with vehicles. You know, some of them are really sturdy in comparison to others. Some of them are extremely flimsy. You know, I think that is one of the key contributions, I think, that the trials will make to central regulatory, well, the work they're doing to work out how they are treated in law. And, you know, what standards, if, for example, they say, right, we're going to deem them in law as an e-bike, what standards do they put alongside that? And I think that's a really key question. There is one thing, though, I do want to say, is that with all of this, you know, they're going to be part of the mix, I think. You know, I also feel that the door has been opened. We can't put the genie back in the bottle. But they're only part of the mix. And people have a love-hate relationship with e-scooters. I'm not yet convinced of the evidence that they are counted, should be counted as active travel. You know, we in London want people to be, you know, physically cycling. You know, it may well be they're a good thing if they're taking people out of cars for the reasons we've discussed before. They take up less space. As was said, I think it was Anthony, I think, raised in the Q&A, you know, really concerned that we have strong controls over not littering the pavement. You know, we need to, you know, our view is absolutely, you know, pavements are for pedestrians. You know, they should not be mixing. This is where, if you look at the data around the world, it's when you have pedestrians and e-scooters mixing, that's when you have real safety issues. And we need to really make sure that pedestrian space is protected for them. And so I think, you know, it's the latest hype thing. And as with all of the hype curve issues, you know, it comes along, it feels like it's going to be the thing. You know, come into the TfL control room, you know, watch the immense effort that goes around managing the, you know, the 6,300 traffic light junctions in London and managing emergencies on the network, the bus network. You look at how the streets are running, you'll go, scooters, yeah, they might help a bit. You know, and so I think that they're exciting, and the people that love them really love them. The people that dislike them really hate them. And I think the key thing for us is to say, look, assuming the technology is here, we need to shape the policy, shape the regulatory powers, shape the vehicle standards, so that if they do become part of the mass market, then they're as safe as possible, as reliable as possible, and actually protect the issues of all Londoners, and don't just give a cool option for the people that feel able or willing to use them.
Great, thank you. I'm gonna pull us up to away from e-scooters and away from some of those very interesting details. We've got a question here from Tim Fryer of Engineering and Technology magazine. I'd like to pull in Natalia and John on this. He's got a much broader issue on, you know, how do we use the opportunity that we've had now? We've seen across a whole range of areas that lockdown and the pandemic has sped up a number of different areas of our life, things that were potentially happening anyway, that were maybe going to happen over a number of years. And how do we avoid going back to where we were before and use this as an opportunity to a greener future? And I'll put that to Natalia first, if you want to give that a go. And actually, before I go in there, I'm going to chuck in my own point there on electric vehicles, because I've looked into buying an electric vehicle myself. And one of the fundamental things that's stopping me is the fact that I don't have a front garden that you can drive into and plug it in. And I'd have to run the lead over a public footpath. So if you can answer that question for me, that would be brilliant.
I will start answering that question with the fact that I also don't have that, but I do have an electric car. We park it on street and we charge it down the road. Our local authority installed some chargers. Yes. It's not as convenient as a person who can charge at home. That is definitely the cheapest and most convenient option. But there's also a lot of innovation taking place in that space. So you'll notice it if you look closely, a lot of boroughs installing street lamp chargers. We're involved in innovation projects around chargers hidden in the pavement. Yes, it's not quite solved for people who don't have off-street parking, but it's definitely feasible even today. You know, even charging on the public network, where it's more expensive than your own domestic electricity, it's still far cheaper than petrol or diesel. So that is possible. I guess going to the broader question around how do we take the learnings, I guess the positive learnings from COVID, and I'm going to interpret that as, I guess there's a refocus on what's important in life and where we spend our time and who we spend our time with, but also there's been a focus on the world we live in, right? Like we've got out of like the four walls of the office and we spend our days in not just a building Monday to Friday. And I think we're becoming a bit more conscious about the impact we're having on the world. And transport clearly has a big part to play in that. You know, transport accounts for a big percentage of emissions in our country and globally. And so I think we need to try and harness this public understanding. I think this consciousness that we're starting to now get. And how do we do that? I'm not sure I have a unique solution. I'm not sure there is kind of a one solution, but I think the government has to give a very clear indication of what they're going to back. You know, we've touched upon this already around the green recovery and you know, what we invest into and what we support. But I think there's also a role for private sector and, you know, for companies like ours. You know, we're an energy company with quite a big customer base now and have an opportunity to really speak to customers in different ways. And, you know, the green agenda is at the heart of what we do, but it's bigger than that. You know, like we engage with companies across all types of sectors every day, and everyone can pull sustainability into that. And so I think there's got to be a mandate there. I'm not quite sure how you make that happen.
Great, thank you. John, anything you'd like to add on how we can make the most of the opportunity we have now?
If I knew how we could actually sort of do that and embed a green revolution at this point, I would probably be a lot richer and more successful than I in fact am. But I am slightly concerned that there was that point early in summer where like Grant Shapps unveiled his big transport master plan, and it was actually quite exciting and progressive. And you know, I was having warm feelings towards Grant Shapps, which was an entirely new and unfamiliar sensation for me. But there were lots of good stuff in that transport plan. And, you know, TfL was coming out with these plans to talk about getting private cars off a bunch of central London roads. We're seeing similar things in Manchester. All this stuff is great. But it is also slightly scribbling around the margins. Like there was another bit of that transport master plan. There was £1 billion set aside for the duelling of the A66 between Middlesbrough and Workington, which is not a massively well-populated route across the north of England. I'm sure that's an important project. I'm sure that'll be very useful economically to Cumbria and Tyneside. That's not Tyneside, is it? Middlesbrough, you know what I mean. The northeast. However, that's still four times the amount that's been set aside for cycling stuff on a single road in a not very well populated part of the north of England. And the danger is and you know, Grant Shapps is now saying that if councils don't consult properly with their residents, they are going to lose this £250 million fund for walking and cycling. So there's not that much money there in the first place. And now it looks a lot like the transport sector is slightly getting cold feet about it. And I think the reason for that is because the people who will lose out from reducing road space tend to be a lot noisier and more visible, and also I suspect a lot taurier than the people who would gain from it. This government has actually been quite good at telling large chunks of the electorate to bugger off because it doesn't like them very much. I think the problem here is that the motoring lobby is probably a bit of the electorate this government is quite keen on. I don't know how we embed this stuff, but I am worried that actually we've probably seen a lot of the progress on that sort of thing that we're going to, and I'm not sure there's going to be much more from here.
Thank you. Right, we've got very little time left and we've got lots of questions. So I'm going to roll questions into each other. We've got a question here from Martin Caulfield of Atalanta Motors, which is a zero emissions delivery vehicle developer. And we've also got a question from Tom Higgs at Octopus Electric Vehicle. Both those questions are looking at zero emissions and at how much the public knows about zero emissions. I'm going to go to the more specific one on from Martin on what immediate push there is to incentivize last mile parcel delivery companies to adopt zero emission solutions, because I find it's always easier to ask something that's quite specific. But if you can also answer from Tom a question more about how we make the public more aware that in just 20 years' time, all new cars need to be zero emissions.
Okay, on the first one, I'm not aware that the government has particularly got a strategy on this. I think I've got a letter into the department waiting for a response at the moment. I think the main driver of it might well be, although some of the clean air zones are sort of slightly up in the air at the moment and being put on hold because of progress has been made in other ways during lockdown. But obviously, if you've got clean air zones in city centres which either impose a charge on polluting vehicles or ban them altogether, then that would be an incentive for companies to look at cleaner alternatives, including e-cargo bikes or sort of vans. There's some concern, you know, if you're talking more generally about white van man in the city centre, is that because a lot of these people would be self-employed and will really have had their incomes hit during COVID, it's asking them quite a lot to then make an investment in a new, in the short-term expensive vehicle. And, you know, that's something that I think we need to see something from the government in terms of how they're going to, you know, in the same way like with the taxi trade, making the transition over, and they've been badly hit during lockdown. But I'm not aware of any specific plans for the government to support people financially or to impose any sort of onus on them to actually do that. On the broader things about EVs and the shift, I suppose 2040 is quite a long way off, and if people are buying vehicles now, you're still would be looking to replace that by 2040 in most cases. But what we have seen is electric vehicles, although we're still, we're nowhere near on course to actually meet, say, a 2035, 100% of new sales being electric vehicles or other clean fuels. It was about 3 or 4% of the market. I think during the last few months, it's got up to about 10% of new vehicle sales, but there's still a long way to go. And the government strategy is just about making the charging infrastructure, you know, rolling it out. I think there was something said in chat about how there were far more charging points than petrol stations, but the big difference is you spend, what, less than 5 minutes at a petrol station, you can refuel your car in no time at all, whereas a charging point, if you want to get it up to 100%, even on the most rapid chargers, you're looking at 45 minutes or so. Wow. So I'm in the same position as Natalia with, I've got an electric vehicle, I live in a block of flats where I can't charge it, so I'm reliant on public charging points. And now, there's competition for them. You sort of go there and somebody else has just started charging, so that means you're facing a 90-minute wait. You know, 45 minutes for them to charge and another 45 minutes for you to charge, which isn't feasible. But I think the sort of answer about the public not being aware will probably pretty quickly be dealt with by the fact that there are so many companies bringing forward new vehicles. The charging infrastructure will start to appear. But as I said right in the introductory remarks, my concern is that when you get into more remote areas, and particularly if you go to rural areas where tourism, say, is big, so Cornwall or Devon or whatever, once you get off the motorway network, you don't get those public charging points. I went up to Northumberland during the summer break, and you know, once you're off the motorway, it's very, very difficult to find somewhere to charge your car. And I think obviously people who live there are quite likely to have the space to be able to drive, charge their car at home. But if you want to encourage tourism in areas that aren't accessible by public transport, then you've got to look at, there might not necessarily be a commercial argument for putting a charging point in place, but at some point it's going to have to be, there's going to have to be that sort of blanket coverage.
Great. I'm going to whiz us on. We've got a question here from Richard Anderson of Imperial College London's Transport Supply Strategy Centre, and I'm also going to roll that into a question from Giles Bailey of Strategy, which is a demand side question, which really probably falls on Michael. Yeah, if you're to be ready for this, both those questions are around how do we deal with the passenger demand being low in city centres? How do we stop a death spiral of lower service levels, less maintenance and investments, which then leads to even fewer passengers?
Well, look, I think you raise a very good point. One perspective on this is that, particularly at the moment anyway, until there is some kind of return of demand. You're seeing transport moving into one of those areas that does require some kind of subsidy for the sake of public good. You know, that was the situation we found ourselves in. We had to come to a funding agreement with the government so we could maintain services. And I think, you know, we're going through certainly a phase, can tell you the length of that, where it's moving into a social good. It's going to require investment. It's going to require, review of what's the most efficient way of funding these things. Because, you know, as you say, you know, of course, so what we want to do is provide an inclusive service that allows people to get away in the best, you know, possible way around the city. We don't want a car-based recovery. And you can make structural interventions like that, but, you know, but keeping a good, reliable, safe service that customers like will require funding. So I think there is a debate to be had about if and how you could restructure a public sector transport finance, for the long term, given what we now know about potentially lower certainty with revenue, but also, as you say, once you've lost transport, and when you've taken services down, it's very hard to bring them back. So I think that, you know, we do need to find a way of doing it, but, you know, I'm afraid I haven't got the answer there, other than it's going to require support until a new equilibrium can be found.
Great. Thank you to all our panelists today. We are Higginson Strategy. This was a Expert Bureau event. If you'd like to hear more about Expert Bureau and our panelists, please do get in contact with us. Thank you to all of you.